right, members, while we're waiting for other folks to head back over from the floor, why don't we get started with Representative Lohmer's bill? And when we do have a quorum, we'll go ahead and move the bill in your A1 amendment, Representative Lohmer. But why don't we just start out by having you introduce the bill, and we'll proceed from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So you want me to just hold off on the amendments till we get a quorum?
Why don't you introduce the amendment, and then we'll vote on it when we have a quorum. If people have questions on it, we can do it at that time.
Okay. So the first amendment is an oral amendment, and we want to insert $1.31 on line 5.19, where there is currently a blank dollar amount. So the reason for the amendment, this sets in statute what the pharmacy dispensing fee for the over-the-counter drugs will be when the automatic drug distribution systems are used by a pharmacy and they are billing for quantities less than the number of units contained in the manufacturer's original package. This will be a new option allowed, should this legislation pass, billing for quantities less than the number of units contained in the manufacturer's original package. So a new pharmacy dispensing fee had to be determined for this new option, which was done in consultation with DHS. And I understand that Sarah Drake from DHS is here if there's any questions about that.
Thank you.
And then I have another amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lohmer, could you repeat the dollar amount for that?
$1.31.
Thank you.
On 5.19.
Yeah, we'll have to repeat that when folks come back. So why don't you just continue on, Representative Lohmer?
Okay, and then the second is the A1 amendment, and so the reason for that amendment is technical and clarifying, and was requested by the Board of Pharmacy. It further clarifies that the containers used in the automated drug dispensing system be provided by an FDA-registered repackager that is also licensed by the board as a manufacturer.
All right.
So that's the A1.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and officially call the meeting to order. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 12, 2015? Representative Halverson moves approval of minutes for March 12th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. Representative Lohmer, why don't you go ahead and just announce or describe the oral amendment. Actually, why don't we have you move the oral amendment and have Mr. Chun read that back for us, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the oral amendment.
Yep. All right. Mr.
All right,
Chun.
Then, Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would be on page 5, line 19. I guess delete the blank and insert $1.31.
All right. Any questions on the oral amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted. Next, Tier A1 amendment, Representative Lohmer, if you'd like to describe that, and we will move that, please.
Mr. Chair, I think I'd ask Dr. Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy if he's here. Is he? Or Jesse? Okay. We'll have somebody come down.
Mr. Chair?
Please introduce yourself for the tape and please describe that. Thank you.
My name is Jessica Androff, Director of Pharmacy Operations from Rowan LTC Pharmacy. In consultation with Dr. Weiberg from the Board, Executive Director from the Board of Pharmacy, he requested additional clarification language to make the A1 amendment state the dispensing system should be provided by a FDA-registered repackager that is also licensed by the board as a manufacturer. That simply clarifies the language so there's no questions in the eyes of pharmacies that are utilizing this.
Thank you. Are there any questions regarding the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Those opposed, no. A1 is adopted. Representative Lohmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 657 contains needed technical updates regarding the use of the automatic drug distribution systems. In recent years, legislation was enacted to allow the use of these automatic drug distribution systems in nursing homes, and since then, the use of these machines has grown due to the increased cost savings, safety, and efficiency that results from their use. So the bill addresses three issues. First, the bill would make it more appealing for the over-the-counter medications to be dispersed through an automatic drug distribution system through medical assistance. Second, it would allow automated drug distribution systems to be used in certain boarding care homes where they are not currently allowed. And finally, it allows the accuracy of the containers used in the automated drug dispensing system to be verified by an FDA-registered repackager. And so at this time, I'd like to ask Jessica Androff, Director of Pharmacy Operations for Merwin LTC Pharmacy, to explain in more detail why this legislation is needed.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Ms. Androff.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Chair Dean, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Androff, and I'm Director of Pharmacy Operations for Merwin LTC Pharmacy. As Representative Lohmer explained, this bill addresses three changes pertaining to the use of automated drug distribution systems. The main change has to do with state regulations around dosage amounts for over-the-counter medications that medical assistants will cover. As currently written, 256B statutorily requires pharmacies to dispense over-the-counter medications that are being reimbursed by Medicaid in a quantity that is the lower of the number of dosage units contained in the manufacturer's original package, so a full bottle quantity, and the number of dosage units required to complete the patient's course of therapy. In recent years, automated drug distribution systems have been approved for use in Minnesota, and ADDS machines dispense medications on a dose-by-dose basis. These systems have been proven nationally to save money. The reason that they save money is because in traditional dispensing, the payer, be it Medicare, Medicaid, private party, etc., is charged for patients for quantities of the medication that are received. So if the patient has been charged for the medication and the medication is discontinued or the patient passes away, the remaining quantity is destroyed. Using ADDS dispensing, the patient has only received the doses that are actually used, dose by dose. There are no additional medications on hand in the case of a discontinuation or change in medication, and the payer is only charged for the doses used. While CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has put a mechanism in place nationally to allow for this, Medicaid in Minnesota is still bound by the statutory requirements in 256B when it comes to over-the-counter medications. By making the changes proposed, pharmacies would be allowed to be reimbursed by Medicaid for only the doses used in this type of system. Additionally, pharmacies would not have to treat patients on the Medicaid system differently than other patients solely based on the reimbursement structure. All patients and payers can receive the benefits of dose-by-dose dispensing. By reducing the dispensing fee for pharmacies dispensing over-the-counter medications in less than full bottle quantities using these systems, Minnesota DHS will be at a minimum fiscally neutral in cases where a standard dispense fee would have been paid for a larger quantity of medication. Lastly, Representative Lohmer also briefly mentioned two other changes made in the bill. The first would allow automated drug distribution systems to be used in certain boarding care homes where they are not currently allowed. And the second allows the accuracy of the containers used in an automated drug dispensing system to be verified by an FDA-certified repackager. Thank you for your consideration, and I would ask for your support of HF 657.
Thank you. Ms. Androff, any other questions? I just perhaps for the members of the committee and for other folks, could you just describe how these work? Because I've had very limited familiarity with it, but they seem to be very safe, functional, and just for people who might not know what the machine is and how it operates.
Certainly, Chair Dean, members of the committee, these systems have been in use nationally for over 10 years. They are intended to be used in skilled nursing facilities. The standard mechanism of delivery in skilled nursing facilities is a central pharmacy that delivers medications via courier, employee, et cetera, to a remote skilled nursing location. That structure of delivery worked many, many years ago when the acuity of patients in long-term care facilities was not as high as it is now. with higher acuity patients in these settings, with hospitals looking to discharge patients on IV medications and other with other complex medical conditions, the necessity to have medications close at hand for urgent medication needs is increasing. Additionally, with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, there are hospitals that are being encouraged to discharge residents, and skilled nursing facilities are being penalized for rehospitalizations. As a result, the Affordable Care Act made some changes in the dispensing structure for skilled nursing facilities, and because of the needs of these patients, pharmacies are looking to install these. These machines are installed on-site at skilled nursing facilities, have a set number of medications in them that are the highest use medications in a facility. A pharmacist is still involved in the process and is accurately entering the order, verifying the order, and then the medication is dispensed on-site. So we're taking delivery time out of the equation for these patients. The Minnesota Board of Pharmacy has been very involved in the process of approval on these machines in the state of Minnesota. They actually go through a review process. They require a 30-day trial where every single dose in the machine is checked by a pharmacist to verify accuracy. And on a national level, the accuracy of at least the machine that we're using, I can't speak for other machines, has been proven to be superior to a national error rate in physical dispensing by a pharmacist.
Thank you. Mr. Berg, I see that we do have a fiscal note on this. And since we are here in the Finance Committee, we do have a fiscal note on this. Could you describe what that is?
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a fiscal note in your packet. It shows that this bill, and I should note it, if you read the narrative, it references the $1.31 rate that we put in the blank. It would save $2,000 in the 16-17 biennium and $4,000 a biennium in after the next.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer, for our first negative fiscal note. We do appreciate that.
$4,000.
We have a little ways to go, I believe. Hey, it's a good start. Thank you for that. Any other questions for Representative Lohmer? Seeing none, Representative Lohmer renews her motion that House File 657 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And 657 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Franzen. Did she escape? All right, we will just take a one-minute break, and when Representative Franzen is back, we will have her begin the bill. There she is.
Sorry.
No hurry, Representative Franzen. We were just taking a little break.
Did you just say no hurry?
No hurry.
I can't take my time.
There you go. Thank you, Representative Franzen. You have House File 1057. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I do. I'm not even sure where is it going. Is it staying here?
Being held over. We are being held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, then. I move House File 1057 to be held over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
All right. And do you have any amendments? I see a 125 amendment.
Yes.
Would you like to address the amendment and get it in the sheet if you'd like to discuss it?
Well, it's simple, self-explanatory. We are striking November 28th, 2011, and just changing the date to February 3rd, 2014.
All right. Does everybody have that? Any questions on that? All those in favor of adoption of the A-125 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
I suppose no. The A-125 is adopted. Representative Franzen, to your bill as adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Child care benefits all Minnesotans. It is a two-generation approach to broader economic security because it helps parents get to work. children to succeed in consistent, safe, nurturing environments. In turn, it helps create a strong, current, and future workforce, which is essential to the future prosperity of our state. Child care should be affordable and accessible for all Minnesota families, but far too many families it isn't. The average cost of care for an infant in a center is nearly $14,000 per year in the state of Minnesota. One way we can help low-income families afford the high cost of child care is through the Child Care Assistance Program. The Child Care, or the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program, has not received critical investments in more than a decade, and the provider reimbursement rates under the program have fallen short. My bill would help families, including the more than 5,500 families on the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program waitlist, afford the care they need. It would also help child care providers afford to accept families using the Child Care Assistance Program by raising the state's reimbursement rate from the 25th percentile of the latest Child Care Provider Rate Survey to the 50th percentile. Currently, two-thirds of provider rates in the state are not covered by the reimbursement rate, forcing providers to accept CCAP families at a financial loss if they are able to afford to accept them all at all. When I was the child care provider, this actually does happen. You would interview with a family, find out that they were receiving some sort of assistance and what their co-payment would be, and determine if you could take that family in based on the rates that I had and the rates that the county was willing to reimburse, and have a discussion with that family if they were able to pay the difference. And sometimes those families were unable to do so. And most of the times I would take those families in at a loss because I believe that children need a safe place to go to. And that they need to be loved, and sometimes those on assistance are the ones that need the most love and care and the stability that family child care can provide. Also, not only just with the cost of child care were extracurricular activities such as taking a bus to the library. Sometimes those parents couldn't even afford the bus ride to the library. Or having the music teacher come in, where private pay families are paying that cost and those that are subsidized are unable to do so. So many times the providers will just pick up those costs as well. And the bill would be raising the rate to the 50th percentile, meaning that around half of provider rates would be covered in full. And that explains the bill, and I do have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. If you'd like to go to your testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Flanagan, and I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Franzen for her leadership on this very important issue and for bringing this bill forward. Thank you as well to Representatives Moran, Albright, Backer, and Lafler for co-authoring this legislation. I'm here today on behalf of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition, a growing group of organizations dedicated to making child care more affordable and more accessible for Minnesota families. We advocate for increasing funding for the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program, raising Child Care Assistance Program provider reimbursement rates, and improving the Child Independent Care Tax Credit to help more low and moderate income families afford the high cost of child care. We know that child care creates broader economic security, and that when child care isn't affordable and accessible, parents struggle to find and keep good jobs. Children may suffer the long-lasting consequences, including those related to academic achievement, brought on by economic insecurity and a lack of consistent and dependable care. And our communities and states suffer because businesses struggle to find and keep the employees that they need. That's why it's so important to increase our state's commitment to the Child Care Assistance Program. CCAP helps hardworking, low-income families afford the high cost of child care. CCAP provides parents with the flexibility they need to work on time and full-time and bring home a paycheck to help meet their family's most basic needs. It can be used to care for children ages birth through 12 or 14 if the child has special needs. According to the Minnesota Department of Human Services, nearly 40% of the children using CCAP are 6 or older. CCAP can be used to cover care during all hours of day and week when parents work, including early mornings, late nights, and on the weekends. And by allowing parents to use any provider accepting CCAP payments, parents can choose a provider that meets their unique needs. I'd like to add that even if the legislature chooses to invest in early education programs, because of CCAP's broad reach in ages and hours covered, an investment in this program is still very necessary. CCAP is a long-standing and effective program, but with more than 5,500 families on the wait list, it is urgently needed to provide more funding. It is not unusual for a family to be on the waiting list for years, and in the process, some families are pushed deeper into poverty. Additionally, the state's reimbursement payment to providers accepting families using CCAP is eroding. Unlike a decade ago, the majority of provider rates today are not covered by the reimbursement, meaning that all providers take CCAP families at a financial loss if they can afford to accept them at all. Representative Franson's legislation makes childcare more accessible and affordable, which in turn allows families to work, provides children with long-lasting benefits and improved economic security and consistent, dependable care, and ensures businesses can find and keep employees that they need. We encourage legislators to support this meaningful increase so vital and program that is so vital to children, families, and communities. As a, my mother was on CCAP when I was growing up. I think I turned out okay. And I think that this is a proven strategy in ending the two-generation cycle of poverty and really provides economic security for families that they really need. I know that I am an example of that, and many other families in Minnesota deserve the same opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to give my kudos to Representative Franzen for a very important bill. We recognize that the importance of this and how it offers the opportunity for parents to work and support their family and while having the ability to have their children go to daycare. And just one comment to the testifier, Ms. Flanagan, I would just like to say happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative France, and I also am appreciative that you're carrying this really important bill for this. You know, we know this is a huge, important issue in the state, and I'll tell you, I've been out door knocking and just run across people who are using this program, and they are so appreciative of it. So it's all over the place, and it's a great program. The questions I have, though, I'm kind of curious about the amendment to the bill that we adopted. And so as I'm looking at this right now, you've got this $270 million appropriation, which is kind of jaw-dropping, actually. That's kind of what this costs, right? It's a lot of money. But
that's not a saving?
Oh. Could we make it a saving?
On the other.
All
right.
Anyway, Representative Franson, I'm kind of wondering couple questions, really. First of all, you know, how the money is going to be directed here between raising rates and reducing the waiting list, both of which are important, or are you thinking that if you raise rates, they'll take more kids and that'll reduce the waiting list? Or I kind of want to understand a little more how that works. But my second question for you is, I want to hear a little bit about how this interacts with some of the other proposals that are out there, because we know that there are a lot of things floating around for childcare right now, proposals for, you know, the quality scholarship pieces, and is this an alternative to those things? Is it meant to be additional to some of the quality pieces, or how are you envisioning this?
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I believe that parents deserve choice in access to childcare. Some may not see a benefit for using the scholarships. Some parents may not want to send their children to the program that's being talked about now, universal preschool. Some parents want to send their children to a home-based childcare. And remember, this is a program that starts at the age of zero as well. And as far as the cost, yes, it definitely is jaw-dropping, but we wanted to start that conversation and show the dollar amount of what it truly does cost. Now, when you ask about, it's $270 million for the biennium, of which $50 million goes towards the rates, $220 million toward enrollment. Would increase the rates for existing enrolled families and enroll families on a waiting list, plus an additional 3,000 families at an increased rate. In your packet, you will find the last 10 years worth of child care providers and the number that we have lost. And as you can see on the very last page, family child care providers, we have lost 3,188 providers. And if you just estimate each provider taking 10 kids, that's a lot of children that do not have access right now currently to in-home child care. And at the rate that the county currently pays, and when families have to look at, when providers look at a family and think, can I afford to take this family into my home? That does create a barrier as well. And so I'd like to address that barrier. And yes, it's $270 million, absolutely. We struggled with that number as well, but we thought it was very important for the committee and for the state of Minnesota to know exactly the true cost of what it takes to get parents to work. And if they are using the program, Representative Liebling, they want to work. They want to put food on the table. They want to provide shelter for their children. They want their children to be able to experience life just like any private pay family can.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Franson. I know you're really passionate about this, and I am too, and frankly, I think our kids are worth it. I really do. And so I like your answer. And I just have to say, this session, we're focusing a lot on older people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even a special committee for older people. And great, all of us care about the elderly, but the children are the future. The children are the future of this state. And I would hate to see us neglect our children. And I would hate to see us have create conflict between generations, because that's not what we're about as Minnesotans. And when I talk to elderly people in my district, they care a lot about the kids, whether they're their own grandchildren or other people's grandchildren. They care a lot about what's happening to our children. So I really appreciate, again, that you're bringing this forward, and I really hope that we can fund this. I'd like to see the whole darn thing funded. Indeed, I would. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, clarifications, perhaps. And I should have been paying more attention when my daughter was lecturing me on this. She's one of those up in Beltrami County that has she's a child care provider out of the basement of our church. So we're talking about CCAP, and I thought I heard something said about CCAP. Maybe I heard wrong, and I think this was to the testifier on 1 through 12. And that I so are we going? Is it go back to infants too?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 0 to 12-year-olds, and up to 14 if a child is identified as having special needs.
Mr. Chair, and now is there a different kind of a rate for an infant? Because, you know, there's a lot more one-on-one time and all that. Is that, I don't know the stuff very good, so.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Purcell, the providers and setters do set their rates, and they do set their rates according to the specific needs. And the state of Minnesota also recognizes that need, and so they do break down by age groups on the max rate that they will reimburse.
And
Representative Purcell.
So I guess one of the things that I'm not quite sure how to get at it, but some folks have in their job situation have, you know, I don't know, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 weeks of maternity leave or whatever, you know, whoever's staying home take care of the infant.
and others don't. And I, does that play into the into this equation for reimbursement or not? Whether folks have access to that. I mean, they can stay home or not. You know what I'm saying? Some folks in their job have access to being able to stay home, and some don't because of the need to work, and they don't have the leave some providers would offer.
Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I guess I'm not quite understanding the question. Could you rephrase it?
Representative Purcell.
Apologize, Mr. Chair. I'm not doing a... What I'm wondering is if there's consideration for those who have access to leave and in their job site, and so there's a rate that is different for those who are able to. I mean, it's a scaled rate, eh? Do I understand that right? The CCAP thing is scaled income.
Yes, that is correct.
And then is there? So some people have access to, they can stay home with their child, infant, and I'm talking about infants here mostly, because it's a, I apologize if I'm not being near as clear as I, what I hear from my daughter is that it takes so much more time for an infant, and she has to limit the time that she can, how many infants she can have, mm-hmm. because she's got to have somebody with that infant almost all the time. That's where I'm headed with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, the state does set guidelines on the ratios of infants, toddlers, and school-aged children, depending on the license that you have,
yeah.
and if you're a center versus child family care. Okay. Does that answer your question?
And it's, Mr. Chair, and it's all considered in this, it's all part of this CCAP that we're talking about.
Representative Purcell and Representative Franzen, I think that the what here Representative Franzen saying is that the ratios that apply to infant are different than those apply to toddler, that are different, they're applied to preschool. I think the one is 12 and under, one is 12 months to 33 months, is that correct? And then 34 months to age 5, is that correct, Representative Franzen?
That's correct. I've been out of the field for a couple of years.
I believe those are the groups by month, and that they each have a different corresponding ratio for how many staff members are assigned to that. So you can only have a very small group of infants, or you can have more preschoolers, and then school age, I believe, is the largest, and it kind of increases. Am I hearing that correctly?
That is correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Purcell, and I'll just bring it back to when I did child care. If I had two infants in my home that was under the age of one and under, I was allowed one toddler, and a toddler is 12 years to two, so that 1 to 2 years of age. If I had one infant in my care, I was allowed to take two toddlers, and the number of preschool children and school-age children varied from that number as well.
Just if I can, Mr. Chair, just I'll wrap up what I'm trying. I'm supportive of the bill, by the way. I don't want to give you any other impression. It's so that the funding that you're talking about, the 200 and some million, is applied to CCAP across the board. I'll leave it there.
That is correct, Representative Purcell.
Thank you. And Representative Franzen, we have Elizabeth Mitchell, Claire Sanford, Heidi Scallet, and Katie Carfoot. We also have a question from Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to wait until the testifiers are done.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And next up we have, is this Ms. Mitchell?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Mitchell.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony, Ms. Mitchell.
My name is Elizabeth Mitchell, and I'm a single mother of a 12-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. I've had quite numerous jobs. I had to quit numerous jobs that don't pay enough for me to afford child care for the hours needed. I qualify for basic sliding fee assistance, but have been on the waiting list a long time with other 6,000 families in Minnesota. Nearly half of my income goes to pay for child care expenses, and there's a struggle every month to find a way to meet my family's basic needs. I recently graduated with an associate's degree in criminal justice, and I hope to find work in my field and go back to school to become a public defender. If I had assistance with the child care expenses, I wouldn't have to constantly worry about how I'm going to pay my bills. If I had basic sliding fee, I can go to work knowing my kids would be cared for. I can go to work and begin to save money for my future education. My children are old enough to understand that money is tight right now. So I do my best to reassure them that everything is going to be okay. But honestly, I struggle every day to believe that myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Next up we have Claire Sanford. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sanford. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And thank you, Representative Franson, for sponsoring this bill and to your co-authors. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am a former teacher in a low-performing, high-poverty elementary school, and I'm also a mother of two young children myself, and today I represent the YWCA of Minneapolis. The YWCA of Minneapolis is the largest nonprofit provider of early childhood education in the state of Minnesota, of nationally accredited early childhood education in the state of Minnesota, serving over 500 infants through school-age children in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak today about increasing access to high-quality early childhood education through changes to provider reimbursement rates in the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP. Everyone has heard the startling and incredible statistics about the return on investment that high-quality early childhood education can give to society, up to $16 for every $1 invested. So I offered this as a reminder that when we're talking about CCAP, we're not only talking about this as a work support for families, it is an investment in children and their education as well. And we also know that our state has one of the most startling achievement gaps in the nation. And the achievement gap, as we all know, is not a political issue. It's one of basic rights. And we know that high-quality early childhood education can dramatically affect the achievement gap. So access to it is an issue of basic rights as well. All children have a right to develop to their fullest potential, and as Representative Franzen noted, all parents have a right to choose the best path of education for their children. And high-quality early childhood education refers to not to an age group, not to a setting, but to an environment. And children can be prepared for school via programs in school districts, for-profit childcare, nonprofit childcare, family childcare homes, churches, what name you. I don't know what I just said, but it didn't make any sense. Thank you. But moving right along. And high quality costs money. And CCAP is a critical program, not only because it helps families access early childhood education, but it allows them to choose the setting that best fits the needs of their family. However, as you've also heard today, we have an astronomical waiting list for families waiting to access basic sliding fee child care assistance. And even for a family lucky enough to get off of that waiting list, the current reimbursement rates offered through CCAP create another barrier to consistent high-quality care. Currently, the maximum CCAP reimbursement rates available for child care providers are for those who have received the highest quality rating through the Parent Aware system in Minnesota, such as the centers run by the YWCA of Minneapolis and countless other for-profit, non-profit, all the different settings. However, even providers eligible to receive this maximum reimbursement rate take on significant risk when serving families using CCAP funds. For example, at my own organization, the YWCA of Minneapolis, the difference between the maximum CCAP reimbursement we can get and the market rates we currently charge is between $25 and $40 a week based on the age of the child. We do charge more for infants because infant care is more expensive, and the state does recognize that and reimburse higher rates for infants because that is more expensive care. So over a year of full-time care, we can potentially lose over $2,000 serving one CCAP-funded infant. And for providers committed to serving lower-income families, this difference can be multiplied hundreds of times over. For example, at the YWCA, 68% of the 500 or so children we serve are considered low-income. So that's 340 children multiplied by what we're losing on every child that we're getting that lower reimbursement rate for. And why is this a risk? Why can't providers just say, great, if you want to come, pay us the difference between what CCAP will pay us and what our market rate is? Many programs do that, but not everyone can pay, obviously. If a family's already struggling to pay a $5 or a $20 CCAP copay each week, the likelihood that they can add the difference that might be $40 between the market rate and the CCAP reimbursement rate on top of that is very slim. And providers end up eating the difference because they know families can't pay it. Or, in extreme circumstances, they don't enroll the child or they expel the family for non-payment. And that leaves those families with extremely few options for high-quality care, which is exactly the care that research shows is needed to create the outcomes we desire as a society. So rates, as they stand now, are effectively wasting taxpayer money on programs that don't get results, because when high-quality providers can't accept families, those families are forced to turn to lower-quality providers, which oftentimes do not get the results we're looking for. And we at the YWCA of Minneapolis and other larger nonprofits are lucky that we're able to fundraise and attract some philanthropic resources so we can subsidize families. So in effect, we're subsidizing families that are already subsidized. But even with such resources, we also turn many families away because the need is always greater than what we're able to do. And in our program, as I said, 68% of the children we serve are from low-income families, 62% of those are households below the federal poverty line, and in addition, 64% are from single-parent families, with 80% identifying as people of color. Even with this incredibly diverse population, year in and year out, over 90% of children leaving our preschool programs are ready for kindergarten, which is roughly 20% higher than the state average. And I say this to demonstrate that we can get results through early childhood education with incredibly diverse populations, and we're by far not the only provider that is doing that. But in order to do it, we need to improve mechanisms for access for both public and private providers. High-quality early education is a proven strategy, working for the children we and many others already serve. It can work for all of Minnesota if given a chance. And CCAP reimbursement rates that are prohibitively low effectively deny access to high-quality programs for low-income children and can serve to concentrate poverty. So thank you for listening, and I urge you to support increasing the CCAP provider reimbursement rate so more families can have access to consistent, high-quality early childhood education. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Next up, we have Heidi Scallop. Welcome to the committee. Please come on down, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Ombisa Scallop. I am a licensed independent social worker. I currently work at the University of Minnesota, where I received my Master of Social Work degree in 2011. I am a mother of two young boys, ages 5 and 4, a kindergartner and a preschooler. Had it not been for child care assistance, specifically the basic sliding fee program, I would not be where I am today, and my kids would not be receiving the high-quality care they need in order to thrive and do well in school. I have been receiving child care assistance through the basic sliding fee program since 2010. I spent 1 year on the wait list, which is far less time than most families might spend on there. Despite having a master's degree, I still have to rely on child care assistance to make ends meet. Social work is not the highest paid field, even at the university. If I were to pay completely out of pocket for full-time child care and daily after-school care for my kids, it would cost me nearly half of my monthly income. Through child care assistance, I pay about $430 per month instead. That is not solely the copay amount I owe, because the county does not fully reimburse the program's tuition. I pay $60 per month in addition to my copay. I know families who have had to leave their child care centers because the remaining balance has been too high for them. Without child care assistance, I honestly don't know what I would do. I have a good job, I have a supportive, family-friendly work environment, but I wouldn't be able to afford high-quality child care on my salary alone. I checked out in-home provider rates, and even that would be too costly for my two kids. My world, and most importantly, my kids' world, would be turned upside down. I rely on child care assistance to help me stay gainfully employed and to set a good example for my children about working hard and contributing to the betterment of society. But I also rely on child care assistance to ensure that my kids have stability in their child care, that they experience a nurturing, supportive environment, and that they are socially, emotionally, and academically prepared to enter school. Without child care assistance, I wouldn't have been able to work full-time and attend school in the evenings and weekends to obtain my Master of Social Work degree. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to further my career path, and I would be making considerably less than I am now. And I'm sure that my kids wouldn't have the positive, supportive, and nurturing learning experiences they receive and they've been receiving through the child care centers. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Katie Crawfoot. Please come on down, introduce yourself for the record, proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Katie Crawfoot, and I'm representing Early Wonders Preschool Project for Pride and Living program. First off, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of HF 1057. It is definitely going to provide much needed support for the state's basic sliding fee child care assistance program. Just to give you a little background on our preschool program, Early Wonders is the full day, year round preschool for children two and a half to the age of five, so that preschool age that you were talking about, 33 months to the start of kindergarten. We are a nationally accredited program, one of nine Hennepin County Strong Beginnings programs, and a four-star Parent Aware rated program. One of the things to note on that Hennepin County Strong Beginnings program, we cannot charge our families more than we are reimbursed from the county assistance. So our rate that we are reimbursed by the county is what we can charge our fee-pay families as well, so small little hiccup in that. We believe that it is vital to offer high-quality early childhood education to all children despite their family's income. Therefore, our program offers a variety of different scholarships and tuition assistance programs to families who qualify, so based on their total gross income. But for us to maintain a sustainable program or business model, we have to serve a few fee-pay families and, more importantly, rely on the child care assistance program to supplement the difference. The child care assistance program allows us to serve families who might not otherwise have access to high-quality early childhood education experiences, and allows us to get reimbursed from the state so that we can maintain sustainability and the quality of our program. It is critical and crucial that the parents and families we serve at Early Wonders have somewhere consistent, safe, and nurturing for their children to go while they are at work or in school. And we believe that while their children are in our care, we offer a wide variety of experiences to help them learn, grow, and prepare for kindergarten and their education beyond. I have a few quotes from parents that I'd like to share that I think really resonate. We have a mother that said, "My daughter would have not been able to receive regular preschool care without assistance. Thanks to Early Wonders, she was kindergarten ready and supported by the staff emotionally." Another preschool parent said, "If we did not receive any assistance for childcare, I wouldn't be able to attend school or work. Knowing that my family is in a safe, loving, and secure environment allows me to focus on providing for them." The families we serve at Early Wonders must be able to work to provide for their family. The child care assistance program supports them in doing so, and the child care assistance program also supports us or the programs that need it to thrive. It's basically a win-win. So I'd like to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk about my program, share my experiences, and my appreciation for the CCAP program.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And discussion to the bill. Our first up, we have Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a couple of questions, and one maybe for Representative Franson or Ms. Flanagan, I'm not sure. I just wanted to make a comment first, I think, about some of the testimony we heard, and that we know that there's someone here who testified and has a master's degree in social work and is struggling to pay for child care says something, I think, about what people are being paid, what working Minnesotans are being paid for the work that they're doing. And I know it's not just social workers, but I know teachers as well who have left work, have left their career to find something that helps them support their family adequately. So I think we should just make a footnote about that, even though that's not the primary topic of our discussion today. I think it's important. So to the bill, and thank you, Representative Franson, for bringing it. I share your commitment to early learning and early quality child care. And I'm looking at all the documents that we have, and the one thing I'm not sure that I can find here is the number of kids currently being served in CCAP and basic sliding fee. And I don't know if you know that current number.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy. Currently, we have, in the basic sliding fee, we have 8,080 families being served. If you break down that down to children, we have 14,786.
Okay. Thank you. And we have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so we have about 8,000 kids on a waiting list. Is that accurate according to the list that I'm looking at here?
On the waiting list, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, 15 counties currently have a waiting list. Of that, we have 5,638 is the total waiting list currently, of which Hennepin County has the largest waiting list of 3,865.
Okay. So the document that we have here with the waiting list history is different than that.
Representative Friends.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yeah, that was just broken down per year. So the latest numbers, the 2015, is not there, but the department last week gave me an updated.
Thank you.
Representative
Thank
Murphy.
You, Mr. Chair. So I looked at this other sheet of child care providers by county, Mr. Chair and Representative Friends, and so what I'm trying to understand here, because there's a lot of, variation by county, and of course there's a lot of variation by population, but do we know in some of these counties that have small numbers of child care providers, or even in the counties like Hennepin County, do we know if there is a shortage of child care providers in general?
Representative Franzen.
Chair Dean, Representative Liebling. Well, by the list that I gave you, as you can see in Hennepin County, over the last 10 years, we have lost a total of 440 providers. The waiting list in Hennepin County is 3,865. So had we not lost 440 providers, we may not have had a waiting list. It's hard to say. There is not a survey that's been done when providers leave the field to find out exactly what has caused them to not want to continue. I know in a town of Henning, the town that I represent, they have an issue with finding child care because the providers there have reached an age where they want to retire, and they don't have anybody younger that wants to come in and fill that role.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Franson. So the bill proposes an increase in the rates and funding to eliminate the waiting list, correct?
Representative Murphy, or Franson, sorry.
Chair Dean. Representative Murphy, that is correct.
And Mr. Chair, I think it's because it's St. Patrick's Day. Really, my head is someplace else. I'm only kidding about that. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, is it your supposition then that if we fund this proposal, $270 million, if we do that and raise the rates, that we would see then a corresponding increase in providers to meet the demand on the waiting list?
Representative Franson.
Representative Dean, Representative Liebling, Representative Murphy. It is my hope with this bill that, first off, that we're having the conversation on the cost of child care, what not funding the cost of child care is doing to families waiting in order to provide to send their children to child care so they can go back into the workforce. It's the conversation also of it is an expensive program. Now, I certainly don't want this issue to be a partisan issue by any means, by pitting early learning scholarships, parent aware, universal preschool against each other, because it's a conversation that we can have on all fronts. And my focus has always been on the child care portion of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Franson. And I've been talking a lot about early childhood and early learning as well, and I absolutely share your view that we shouldn't be pitting these initiatives against one another. In fact, I think there's a lot of work that we can do to support families and kids in early learning. This session, with the surplus that we face, or with the gift of the surplus that we are experiencing here in Minnesota, I just want to be clear and on the record that I think, as many people have suggested, a diverse early childhood initiative or initiatives those initiatives are going to help us move the needle, I think, on something that's important to me, which is to close the achievement gap. I would love it if we really embraced the idea of ending poverty for this next generation, and I actually think we could make real headway if we made a wise investment. And I think pre-K is a great idea. Of course, I'm talking about that, but I think this is critical. And I just want to make sure that if we make this investment that we have confidence, as you do, I believe, that we will be able to reach those families that are struggling. And I was a person who had two kids at one time, and I needed to go back to work. And, you know, that idea of not being able to find childcare at the time, and, you know, it is both expensive and scarce. It was when my kids were born. It is a little terrifying, right, when you know you have to go back to work and where your kids are going to be. And I was lucky to be able to find someone to come to my home and take care of my kids when they were really little because I had two babies, right? But I can only imagine what it's like for women with young kids and their families having to face this choice across the state of Minnesota if there aren't enough providers. And if we can solve that by raising the rates and making sure there's enough money in the system so that working Minnesotans, working women can get back to work and support their families, I think we're making a big step forward. So, all of that is to say I think this is really important. I know it's super expensive. I heard you say $270 million, and that's, you know, a gulp. But I can't imagine a better investment for our future than investing in our youngest learners, and this is a really critical part. So I just want to make sure and thank you for that and nudge you to work as hard as you can, right, to get this taken care of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Franson and the people behind this bill. I just want to say thank you for bringing it forward because we have way too many families who wait. We did ask the Department of Human Services to do a waiting list report that came out in December, and at least in that report, and I think that's true in the numbers that I'm seeing here, everything about basic sliding fee is by family, not by individuals. So some of the numbers that you heard were actually the number of families that are waiting and the number of families that are being served. The average is about two kids, a little less than that per family, so you can kind of double the numbers. But the part of the reason why they keep the numbers by family is because in some places, like the county I represent, the wait is down now to 2.5 years. It used to be three. And so in that time, there might be another child added on. And so it's by family that you come off the list so that you can get all of your kids cared for and assisted in that. But, you know, the brain science is clear that 0 to 3 is when our brains are still forming and developing and a really important developmental stage. And for some people, it's possible for them to say it's not worth it to work. And they may choose to stay at home, but for a lot of families, that's not at all an option. And what it means is that their kid is going into inadequate care. Or, I mean, I'm sometimes really shocked when I door knock and find kids that are way too young to be home alone in a house, home alone. And I have often returned to talk to the mother at a, you know, a time when she might be there. Because, I mean, one did not know that her 4-year-old, who was supposed to be watched by an 8-year-old, knew how to pull a chair over to the door and unlock the door and was inviting me in. And she didn't know he'd gotten to that point yet. And she wondered where the 8-year-old was who was supposed to be paying attention. And, I mean, that's the unfortunate circumstances when people are waiting, is sometimes they have to rely on either inadequate care or sporadic care, relying on friends and neighbors and relatives that may not be reliable if grandma runs into health issues or those sorts of things. So the other issue I think that we should talk about a little is that the waiting list, as I understand it, grew last year or after the last term because we increased the reimbursement rate for the 3- and 4-star rated providers. And, you know, I don't disagree that we shouldn't encourage and reward those who have pursued higher quality as measured by the STAR program, but we didn't add extra appropriations in at the same time. And the end result was that the waiting list grew even longer because more of the money was going to the families who were able to get into those programs. And so I think as we go forward and make financial choices about this, we just have to realize that, you know, you kind of have to balance the whole program or you might inadvertently grow the list like we did. So thank you. I just wanted to point out those couple of things and to make sure that people understood it's families that we tend to keep track of.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Franzen, maybe you could, I think it would be helpful just for members on the committee to know what the CCAP rates currently are for the different age groups. Is there somebody from the department who can tell us what we currently reimburse for each of the different age groups currently in CCAP? And if not, maybe we could get that to the committee members. Oh, I see somebody coming down. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the testimony and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Elizabeth Rowe from the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. We actually have many, many rates. As Representative Franzen was noting, we have rates for infants, toddlers, preschoolers, school-age children. There are different rates for center care and licensed family, as well as unlicensed, and then they differ to some degree by county. So we have roughly 1,000 rates. There was some materials that were set out that provide information about the current maximum rates in six sample counties. Those rates range from approximately $100 in Faribault County for a weekly rate for a toddler to approximately $225 for a toddler in a center in Hennepin County. Those are just a couple of the many possible maximum rates.
Okay. Representative Franzen, maybe it would probably be helpful for us to get an idea when we're looking at something like this of just what the rates currently are for, let's just say, infants, and that I would imagine that infants in centers in the metro area would be, could you give us just a ballpark figure of what that would be either per week or per month?
Mr. Chair, the infant rates for centers would be probably in the $250 to $300 range. We can provide some specific rates if that would be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, that would be helpful, I think, if just so we can get an idea of per week or per month exactly what we're currently looking at per child enrollee. That would be good. Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair and members, and the state also breaks it down to an hourly rate on a daily rate as well as a weekly rate as well.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Franzen, can you wrap up?
Yes. Thank you, members, and Mr. Chair, for allowing us to present this bill today. I do know that we've got a lot of decisions to make, and this is one piece of that moving puzzle. For me, when I did child care, I'll share a story, which I know many of you have already heard this story, but when I started, one of my very first families was on the child care assistance program. It was a mother who had was recovering from a meth addiction, and some of her children had been taken away, and she was holding on to two of her children, and she was sober, and she wanted to stay sober, and she had a job that needed her to be there at 4:45 in the morning. And so when I interviewed with her, I'm certainly not a morning person at all, and at that time I wanted to open up at 6 a.m., which is still way too early for me. When she interviewed with me and I met her children, I love kids. I grew up in a turbulent childhood, and I understand what it means in what kids need in order to feel like they're loved and that they're secure. And I looked at those children, and when she told me that she needed somebody at 4:30 in the morning, and I said I would do it. And so that, you know, she had a fast food restaurant job, but she wanted to put food on her table. She wanted to be providing for her family, and child care assistance allowed her to do that, to show her children that there was work ethic and hard work and determination pays off. And she is sober to this day with her children, owns her own house, and just that little bit of encouragement that she received. What saddens me, members, is that sometimes the child care assistance, it just isn't enough sometimes for those families when the state sets their rate lower than the current market value, and it pits those children of the haves and the have-nots. And when you have a child care, when you have providers that don't want to deal with the paperwork, that they don't want to deal with the hassle that the regulation from the state from taking in the families, those children, those on assistance, also don't get to see just other children being able to blend together and having those role models in that home. When I would make the children lunch, I would sprinkle their food with love. And one mother called me up and she says, "What are you sprinkling in the food? So-and-so wants to know. She wants me to put love in the food." I'm like, well, I just, you know, every time I make the meals, I tell the kids that it was sprinkled with love because I want them to know that they are loved no matter what income level they are. And to encourage kids to reach for the stars, and no matter their situation, if they strive hard enough and they work hard enough, they can get there. And the child care assistance program allows parents to go to school, to earn that degree, to reach for the stars, to go to work, to just to be a role model to their children as well. So I do know that there is a lot to think about, and certainly I never promised the moon to anybody, but that we wanted to have the conversation on what it takes, and I want all children to have equal opportunity to survive and to succeed in life. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franzen, and thank you to the testifiers who came down today for the testimony. And with that, Representative Franzen continues her motion that House File 1057 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. As amended, House File 1057 is laid over for possible inclusion. All right. Next up. Representative Durwas. Representative Durwas, please introduce your bill, whichever one you'd like to do first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'll move House File 977 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Representative Durwas moves House File 977 be recommended to be laid over in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Durwas to the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 977, which would increase the appropriation to the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund by $6.5 million. This is a DHS grant program that offers funding for wraparound supportive services to Minnesotans who have experienced long-term homelessness. A person experiencing long-term homelessness, for definition, has been homeless for more than 1 year or has had more than four episodes of homelessness in the last 3 years. These funds combine intensive supportive services with housing opportunities to achieve what everyone desires, housing stability and better health outcomes. I have a few testifiers. In the interest of brevity, I will stop talking and let's hear from the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Durwas. We have Charlie Cook from Hearth Connection. And Shannon Avery, please proceed in whatever order you would like.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Cook. I am the executive director of Hearth Connection. Hearth Connection is an agency that competes on behalf of county collaboration for grants from the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund allocated through the Department of Human Services. We currently manage service delivery in 34 Minnesota counties, representing six separate collaborations. I'm here today to speak in support of the $6.5 million increase contained in HF 997. You heard about the Long-Term Homeless Support Services Fund during the HF 1054 testimony last week. I'm here today alongside Representative Zerwas with our standalone proposal and want to provide further insight on the fund and specifically what Hearth Connection does so well. Endorsed by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, supportive housing is an evidence-based best practice for ending homelessness for people with service needs. I could tell you about great stories about men and women who are now managing their lives and their health better after years of homelessness and the chaos that that brings, or about the 10-year-old who stayed in the same school for the first time in her young life after being housed under these funds. But you've probably heard a lot of that. So I would rather focus on the return on investment for the state and the communities in which we all live. On any given night, there are some 14,000 Minnesotans, half of which are under 21, who are homeless. Of the nearly 600 households that Hearth Connections currently serves, the average time spent homeless is 7.2 years. Nearly 80% of those we serve have mental health issues, 50% have a substance abuse disorder, most have a chronic illness, an intellectual disability, traumatic brain injury, and most are victims of trauma. Over 30% of the adults we serve were homeless as children. Homelessness is incredibly expensive. Once stably housed, we know that the cost of emergency department visits, hospitalizations, law enforcement, and EMS response drops dramatically. Costs related to incarceration and detox are also greatly reduced. With the service supports provided through this funding, people manage their lives, their health, and their relationships better, saving money and building real lives. Currently, the Long-Term Homeless Support Services Fund is funded at $11.82 million for the biennium. This money presented today provides supportive services in six regional county collaborations, including two tribal nations. None of these funds are allocated to the central regions of the state. We know that there are long-term homeless Minnesotans statewide, and I believe the $6.5 million increase to this fund would truly make this a statewide program and would offer greater access to services in rural areas for tribal nations. This funding represents an investment in the lives and the well-being of children and adults facing tremendous barriers to stability, health, and contribution to community. Some brief outcomes in terms of the services that we provide at Hearth Connection. Only over 70% of the people that we have served, and since 2006, Hearth Connection has worked with 1,300 plus households. 70% have been stably housed for at least 1 year currently, after being homeless for over 7 years. 35% of those exited, we've exited or people have left our services, 705 people have left, or households have left our services in that amount of time. 35% of those exited have matured out of the program and onto independent living. 25% of those exited have matured out of the program and moved back to live with family or friends. And another 25% have moved on to subsidized housing without services. We see so many improvements in the lives of those we served. Once stably housed, family relationships improved. Participants are able to manage health and mental health far better. They have less involvement with emergency services, courts, and detox centers, and more involvement in the community. This could not be possible without the investment by the state in the Long-Term Homeless Support Services Fund. On behalf of those who are served through this funding, I hope you will support HF 997 and by including it in your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. We have Ms. Avery, Mr. White, and Ms. Magistad yet on House File 977. We do have one more bill today, which is House File 972 with testifiers. So I could ask that if testifiers could please keep their testimony very brief, we'll be able to get through the bills before 2:30. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and distinguished members of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. My name is Shannon K. Avery, Tribal Planner Developer for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. The Leech Lake Reservation Business Committee, RBC, District 2's Representative Steve White is also present. I will be testifying on behalf of Mr. White and myself in respect for time. Mr. White is the founder of the Leech Lake Homeless Shelter. Mr. White wanted to express his personal support for House File 977 that addresses long-term homeless supportive services. I'm here to express the Leech Lake Reservation Business Committee's support for HF 977, the bill that is presently before the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. A key part of this bill will address the long-term homeless supportive service concerns in the state of Minnesota. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has been experiencing a crisis with the number of families that are homeless, an issue that we see continuing to grow with each passing year. In 2014, the Leech Lake Veterans Memorial Grounds had 100 people living in tents at the Powwow Campgrounds. The Ball Club Powwow Grounds had over 25 people living in tents as well. The Leech Lake RBC has been notified by the Cass Lake Bena High School officials that 78 children were homeless and the school was allowing the children a place to sleep and shower. Presently, the Leech Lake Housing Authority has reported about 700 families are on the Leech Lake Housing waiting list. The Leech Lake Housing Authority has also identified 445 people were surveyed as homeless by the Wilder Foundation survey for Leech Lake in 2012. The Wilder Foundation survey had also reported that 25% of those people defined as homeless are children. These are the facts and statistics Leech Lake has uncovered, but please consider all the unreported homeless families flying under the radar screen. Homelessness is an issue needing to be addressed. Honorable Chair, this completes my statement on behalf of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I would be grateful to answer any questions from the honorable members of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Avery and Mr. White. We appreciate you coming down from Leech Lake today. We may have some additional questions after the last testifier, which is Caitlin Magstead. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Caitlin Magistad. I'm a case manager with Project Quest, a supportive housing program that receives long-term homeless supportive service funding through Hearth Connection. Having worked in both emergency shelter and supportive housing programs, I have seen that the paths in and out of homelessness are varied and complex. Beyond the issue of housing affordability, people often become homeless due to challenges with their families of origin. Many of the parents I work with were homeless as children with their families, or were forced into homelessness as unaccompanied youth, fleeing family violence, abuse, and other threats to their safety and well-being. Breaking the cycle of long-term homelessness requires comprehensive interventions. Minnesota offers a range of housing services. Programs like Project Quest represent the more intensive end of the spectrum for those that face higher obstacles to housing stability. 65% of the adults in my program experience a significant mental health concern. 25% have a physical disability. Other challenges include chronic health conditions, children with special needs, developmental delays, and other challenges. In 2014, Project Quest served 49 households, including 101 children. Anytime we have an opening, it is quickly filled with a new referral, and we know that there are families out there that need this level of service that Project Quest provides that are not able to get into our program due to limited funding. Long-term homeless supportive service funding allows my program to provide intensive wraparound services to families. Each family works with a case manager, a housing specialist, as well as a children's educational advocate to work together to develop goals and connect to services and resources that will help them meet their needs. Supportive housing services provide an opportunity to become more productive, healthy members of our society. We know that supportive housing saves money, allows people to gain financial stability and skills to manage their money, and access job training and other independent living skills. Please support House File 977 to increase funding for the long-term homeless supportive services. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. That's it we have on the list for testifiers. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing no takers, Representative Zerwas. Do we have any questions for Representative Zerwas on House File 977 or comments? Ms. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Zerwas, a question I see on the research is helping to help to sustain the individuals when it comes to homelessness, but it also states help for families. So I'm just curious, how does that relate to what is exactly involved in helping the families in dealing with homelessness? Because it's a bigger issue than just a one individual.
Representative Zerwas.
Yep, and I'll start, and I think I might have a phone a friend tell me a little bit about some more specific examples. But I think in the years that I've been here, one of the biggest compelling things I've seen around addressing homelessness is the idea that providing a roof over someone's head isn't sustainable or a long-term solution, and that anything we do to address homelessness or housing issues needs to be in conjunction with exactly the type of supportive services that we've heard a little bit about. And so I'm sure the testifier can list off some examples of some of the things that his group works on with these families.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. Cook, if you could answer the question, that'd be great. Thank you.
I'll do my best. As I understand it, what you're asking, Representative McDonald, is around how it might differ between single individuals and families?
That is correct.
Okay. Typically what's happened is when a person has been, to be served by this program, they have to, as Representative Zerwas mentioned, be homeless for a long time. So people have to not only fall off the cliff, they have to stay off there and not be able to climb back on their own for at least a year, or have several opportunities like that over the last 3 years. It doesn't really matter to us whether it's an individual or a single. In each case, what we would do with that individual is our provider would help them find housing of their choice. This is scattered site. This is not a big building someplace. It's within the community and of their choice. So when we can find a subsidy through either HUD, federal subsidy, or the state mental MHFA, and pair that subsidy with that individual in the neighborhood or in the area that they want to be, and then from that help them with tenancy support, getting their kids into school, getting the proper access for health care, mental health care, any sort of long-term health needs that they may have, and getting them connected, in addition to helping them to connect to mainstream services like Medicaid or Social Security income, whatever it is that they might need to help stabilize their circumstances. I'll mention that this is a housing first model. In other words, we house people first, regardless of what issues they're facing, and use that housing stability as a strength to build more stability over time. Is that helpful?
Thank you, Mr. Cook and Representative Zerwas. Any final concluding remarks for Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your consideration of this bill. I think when we look at the work that's being done both by our tribal communities and by examples like the Hearth Connection, we see really great work that's focused on stabilizing families and helping people get their legs under them so they can start, as the testifier said, that long climb back out of the hole. And so I think that's what the bill aims to do. So I thank you. With that, I'll renew my motion.
Thank you to the testifiers, particularly those that traveled down for this today. And with that, Representative Zerwasser renews his motion that House File 977 be recommended to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
No. House File 977 is held over for possible inclusion. House File 972, Representative Zerwas, would you like to move House File 972 be held over for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chair and members, I will move that House File 972 be laid over for possible inclusion. And then I have an A2 amendment. I'd move the A2 amendment at this time.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 972 as well, and also moves the A2 amendment. Discussion to the A2 amendment. Seeing no discussion to the A2 amendment, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas to House File 972 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The A2 amendment addressed some of the concerns that were highlighted in the Health Policy Committee. Removing one of the limitations that we had as far as the number of employees to make sure that we actually have providers that can qualify for this. And then we readdressed the rural versus urban component that was in the bill and better defined who would administer the grant and who the grants would be for. And with that, Mr. Chair, members, there are a few testifiers. I informed them at this point of the day, brevity is appreciated.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And to the testifiers, please just go in order, say who you are and where you're from, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Chairman Dean and members of the committee. My name is Claire Hauser, and I'm joined by my classmates Elizabeth Coates and Christopher Plotch from Concordia University, St. Paul. We have many traditions at Concordia, and one of them is turning the Capitol into our real-life classroom. We've researched, drafted, and passed legislation over the past few sessions that we are very proud of. This year, I couldn't be more thrilled to talk to you about the Smile Healthy Minnesota Legislative Act, or House File 972, which is chief-authored by our mentor, Representative Nick Zerwas, and then in the Senate, our companion bill is chief-authored by Senator Julie Rosen. We have both good and bad news. First, the bad news, Minnesota, we have a grim healthcare reality that needs to be faced today. There is a dentist shortage across Minnesota, specifically rural Minnesota.
Chris Plotch. We have a bigger problem. Residents of group homes, special needs patients on Medicaid, and vulnerable adults with disabilities aren't able to have dental access for proper care in rural Minnesota, primarily the Northwest Quadrant. We've heard many patient stories similar to this one, and adult group home residents with mental and physical disabilities is strapped to a wheelchair. Some are from like Waro, Minnesota. They have to travel 4 or 5 hours all the way down to the Twin Cities. They have to strap the patient into the van, and it turns out into a 10 to 12 hour total trip, and they also sometimes have to stay overnight with the patient. This isn't a one-time incident. It's a hardcore reality for Minnesotans with special needs needing dental care across Minnesota. Now for the good news. For 2 years, we've researched, studied, talked with agencies and legislators about a solution. We believe, along with Representative Zerwas and Senator Rosen, we have a straightforward answer to this pressing problem.
Elizabeth Coates. We believe that creating an opportunity for those nonprofit organizations that wish to create mobile dentistry units is a smart, efficient, effective, and fiscal answer. From special chairs to all the right equipment, these mobile units are critical to ensuring dental access across all of Minnesota. House File 972 creates a new Minnesota grant of $500,000 through the Department of Health and Human Services to go to the patients. We would like to help provide funding and bring dental mobile units to Medicaid patients most needing access, treatment, and care. With our cooperative efforts, we hope to start seeing the smile back in our most vulnerable Minnesota residents. We want a solution. We want to see progress made. Members and Chairman Dean, we ask for your support and leadership in passing House File 972. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Platch, Ms. Coates, Ms. Hauser. Excellent job with your testimony. Welcome to the Capitol today, and glad you are working on your civics and education at the same time. Appreciate that. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Thank you, Chairman. If there's questions, we can answer questions. Otherwise, I'll wrap it up.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, the amendment that we added to the bill talks about the shortage area as defined in the Code of Federal Regs, et cetera, located outside the seven-county metro area. I think that excludes Rochester, if I'm not mistaken, because, and maybe somebody from the department is here that could speak to that, but the problem is that the way these shortage areas are defined doesn't really take account of the fact that people who are in these situations that your testifiers have discussed still can't access dental care. And in fact, Rochester's had a terrible problem with dental access for poor people, part of which is being resolved by AppleTree and other groups now. Things are a lot better. But I think your amendment actually excludes Rochester, and I wonder if that was your intent. First of all, if you know whether that's the case or whether that was your intent.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leland, I guess I would defer to House research on the defined area. That's not our intent, and if we need to have a fix, that's something we would be open to.
I see Mr. Schoenbaum here. Would you like to approach, please? And if you can shed some light on that would be great. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you can tackle that. That would be great.
Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Liebling. There is no such thing as a perfect shortage area measure. You experienced in Rochester one of the imperfections of this measure. You're correct. Rochester is not so designated.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Schoenbaum, don't leave, please.
Almost. Representative Liebling.
Not fast enough, I guess. So that makes it sound like you can't think of a fix for this language. Can you think of a fix for this language that would make it apply in Rochester as well? Because, I'm kind of not that comfortable voting for this. I mean, I realize it's a problem all over the state, but it's certainly a problem in my area. I'm sure Representative Pearson is concerned about this as well. We both are working on dental issues.
And we have another,
he's carrying a bill for, to deal with this issue as well, but I would hate to have us here be passing a bill that specifically excludes my area where I know there are terrific problems.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe we have provided technical assistance on this issue on another piece of legislation this year. There's also probably no such thing as a perfect fix, but there is improvement, and we'd be happy to provide technical assistance to any member that's interested.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum.
And to the author, of course.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
And I know we're just about to finish up here, but so, Representative Zerwas, I take you at your word that you'd be willing to make a fix for this. I don't know what the I don't know if that would have to, maybe when the omnibus bill comes out, I guess would be the place to do that, but I appreciate that. I'm sure Representative Pearson does as well, and want to make sure it applies everywhere it's needed. So thank you.
Representative Zerwas, is there a temporary crown and a permanent filling coming in the next bill?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Members, oh boy, we will work together to make sure. That certainly was not the intent for that, and we'll make sure to address that moving forward. And members, just as we wrap this up, I don't think there's a single silver bullet that will take care of this issue. I know there, I'm an author of a much larger bill that looks at MA reimbursement rates around dental as a potential root cause. We'll keep the bad puns going. But I think this is more of a bridge. And so, or maybe a partial fix, if you will.
That's funny.
All right, I'm running out of dental puns. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need a filling from you, Representative Zerwas. How come Apple Tree, who provides this service all over our state, especially the metro area, but all of the state, how come they're not, wouldn't be applicable to your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment addressed that issue, so those providers are no longer excluded.
Oh, they are. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. I just want to acknowledge you. Thank you. I didn't realize that.
All right. With that, Representative Zerwas renews his motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. And held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, members, we are adjourned.